Hi, I'm Robin, and this is Beneath the City is Soil, a journey into the future of today, a collection of conversations with humans engaged in worldbuilding projects, rehearsals of human and ecological flourishing emerging from the decomposing matter of a late capitalist system that has set our world on fire. Part 1. Citizens, not subjects. I grew up in West Dorset in the southwest of England. I lived in a small village of 200 people that was located on the private land of the Rackleford estate. A lot of my time was spent wandering through fields and exploring local woodland. I would hop over fences and pass private keep-out signs because I didn't really understand what they meant. Surely I could keep wandering and wandering in the surroundings of my own home. I couldn't comprehend the concept of trespassing. What do you mean this land isn't mine to explore too? I remember day trips to Poole and Bournemouth along the A31. Everyone knew that road. It was the road that had the longest brick wall you'd ever seen, obscuring the view of the Charborough estate. 14,000 acres of land claimed by William the Conqueror after 1066 from Anglo-Saxon control, later given to Norman knights. Colonizer of Barbados in the Caribbean, James Drax had a great-grandson who took possession of Charborough Estate through marriage in 1719, with their family wealth extracted from their role in the transatlantic slave trade. The Drax family owned and still own sugarcane estates in Barbados. It's estimated that close to 30,000 enslaved African men, women, and children died on the Drax plantations over the span of 200 years. And descendant Richard Drax was a Conservative Member of Parliament for South Dorset from 2010 until 2024. When you pass that wall and the Charborough estate along the A31, and those keep-out signs I would see walking through my local woodland, they serve as a reminder of how colonialism, imperialism, and enclosure has cut off our connection to the land. It reminds us of the origins of an imposed feudal system that made way for the ownership class that still holds much power over our economy, our politics, and our society today. Globally, the billionaire class, through capitalist logics, have dictated that human and non-human life is less valuable than the pursuit of profit and power. As a result, globally, 12 people own more wealth than 4 billion of us. In the UK, the richest 50 families hold more wealth than 50% of the entire population. That's the wealth of over 34 million people combined. And by 2035, the wealth of the richest 200 families is forecast to be larger than the whole UK GDP. It's a set of logics that has manufactured our consent to a system underpinned by political corruption and worker and environmental exploitation and precarity. A system of exhaustion that leave little time and energy to show up for others and ourselves with attention and care. A system that makes it easy to forget that we are nature, part of a global ecosystem that makes all of life on Earth possible. We know that this economic system has driven our delicate ecosystem out of balance. So what do we do about it? Our political system is shifting, but it's slow. So what new world can you and I build in the here and now? We'll speak to 8 humans over this series who are taking their future into their own hands, rehearsing a world that facilitates human and ecological flourishing today, here in my current home of London. But first, let's understand why access to land shapes the systems and disconnect we are experiencing in the present moment. I got on a train to Devon, where I headed out on a walk into the orangey autumnal light with Right to Roam campaigner, environmental social scientist and outdoor educator, Lewis Winks.
Yes, I moved to Devon 17 years ago now. I took a job working for the Field Studies Council. In fact, I remember I finished some training up in North Wales. And at the end of that 2 months, I was given an envelope and it just said, "You're going down to Devon."
Really?
So there I ended up just down here, kind of sent down here at Slapson Lee Field Centre, which is down here on the coast. Beautiful place, right in the middle of a nature reserve, next to a beautiful shingle beach. And as a geographer, yeah, I loved it. I was in my element. And yeah, learning to work with groups of young people outdoors, running geography and biology and ecology field trips, you know, and then later had the opportunity to take that interest into research. And I did a PhD at the University of Exeter, which followed, you know, a similar thread, a lot of working with groups in the outdoors. And then I think that curiosity of, you know, what's the importance of these experiences for young people, for, you know, how their lives unfold. Yeah, I mean, I'm pleased to have been able to do that work, and to be able to kind of follow it into research. And obviously now working mostly as a campaigner was the next logical step for me, understanding those issues to advocating for them for other people.
As you can hear, there were visible signs of a flooding event of the River Dart that had occurred just a few days before our recording. Many locals have said it was the highest they'd ever seen it, with some houses experiencing flooding. It was a very real reminder of our changing climate, with increasingly warmer and wetter winters each year.
If you just go up here, you just nip down on the other side of the...
Lewis now spends most of his time campaigning with the Right to Roam, a land access campaign pushing for a Right to Roam Act, a law granting us responsible access to roam and enjoy land and water in England and Wales, matching that of Scotland and many other countries around the world. I asked him why land access was such a live and important issue.
Yeah, why should it be that just by merit of where we live or who we are, we get to have experiences which are so deeply fundamental? I mean, we all know the benefits they have for mental health, physical health, but yet the opportunities to have those experiences are just vastly unequal, and largely because of the way in which our kind of access has been shaped by centuries of land ownership and, you know, wealth and acquisitions of assets and, yeah. And our laws, you know, the laws that govern our rights in the countryside. I mean, here where we're walking on the Dartington estate, we can walk next to the river here, but we don't have a right to be here, not on a public right of way. We're here because the landowner, Dartington Hall Trust, gives a permission for the public to be here. You know, there's nothing to say that that permission won't be revoked in years to come. We don't have that locked in as a right, and that's the same in many places. Our access really is, as we see in our campaigning work, revoked at a whim. Yeah, so the Right to Roam campaign today is simply the latest incarnation of a much broader land justice movement, which is international. I mean, you know, the effects of colonialism and enclosure obviously don't stop at the at the edge of England. I mean, it's colonial enterprises of our, you know, history. It extends globally. From a land access point of view in England, we trace our roots back to the 1930s, the mass trespasses on Kinder Scout and elsewhere, where people from the cities, you know, wanted access to their uplands, to the distaste of the gamekeepers who used violence to keep them away. And some of those trespasses have resulted in a really, you know, bitter struggles. But we have those campaigners to thank for the access that we have really in our uplands, and certainly we have them to thank for the national parks that we enjoy today. The campaign, you know, later evolved in the 1990s, where organisations like the Ramblers started to push for greater access rights, and in the year 2000 that resulted in giving us greater access to certain land types like mountain, moor, heath and downland. And so the legacy of that is that the Countryside and Rights of Way Act that was passed in the year 2000 and given royal assent in 2005 is that we have now access to 8% approximately of England. Now that 8% is still mostly found in the uplands, with small fragments in downland areas and heathland areas. But because of where that land is found, it's really unequal. I mean, you know, we're lucky down here because we've got Dartmoor nearby. Mm-hmm. Dartmoor National Park has large areas of commons that give the public rights of access. But if you just go elsewhere, for example, you go to Kent, then only about 3% of Kent has a legal right of access. If you go to South Downs National Park, that's only about 6% of that national park. So it's really unequal. There are parts of the Midlands that have less than 1% of the area of their county. So the campaign in its current form is trying to do something about this inequality of access. And we've been campaigning for 5 years now for something similar to what you might find in Scotland, which is a presumption of responsible access to land and water. In England, presently, the situation is that we have a presumption of exclusion with some very minor exceptions. And often for the public, that doesn't make much sense on the ground. You don't really know where you can go, and there's often not very much connectivity between landscapes, and many, many people are left out entirely from any kind of access to the countryside. In Scotland as well, there's a right of access to inland water, so rivers and lakes and reservoirs have the right to swim, the right to paddle. In England, there is no such right. So we have less than 4% undisputed legal right of access to our rivers in England. In Scotland, every river is accessible for swimming, paddling. So there's a lot of work to do. I mean, certainly as a campaign, we're full of admiration for those campaigners in the 90s, but really it represents unfinished business by the Labour government that brought in that legislation. It was a step on the road to bringing about equality of access to the countryside, but it's still got a long way to go. So our campaign is single aim really is to bring about a once in a generation shift in the way in which we see access legally, and to bring in new legislation to give a right of responsible access. The plight of our rivers, the farmland and the sewage input into our rivers. The alarm has been sounded by people who deeply care and are passionate about their rivers, and they build that passion through access. So it's been the swimmers, it's been the kayakers, it's been the anglers, it's been the walkers who have raised the alarm on our rivers. And so, you know, that's one example of how people's connection with the outdoors, with nature, can be absolutely pivotal in changing the trajectory of the well-being of the natural world. I mean, if we're locked out from environments around us, from our countryside, from our rivers, from our forests, then, you know, how are we to know when they're in a bad state? I mean, most people don't really respond to large amounts of data and reports. Yeah. The majority of people respond when they're out for a walk, perhaps a regular walk they do near to their home, and see something's amiss. Environmentally, this is about healing a rift that's emerged between humans and the rest of nature. But I think surely part of the healing of that has to be about doing away with these arbitrary exclusions that we have, these lines in the countryside that literally divide us from the rest of nature. Yeah, for children who are out for walks and see keep out, private, do not enter, no trespassing, you know, this is how we learn. This is how we culturally manifest the current state of things. You know, we're told that this narrow trackway that we're on is for us, but, you know, don't you walk off it, you know. But why? You know, nobody really questions why. And then when we do walk off it, often we have most incredible experiences, and I think people can act in guardianship and stewardship for land. And, you know, stewardship is that word which is so often reserved only for those with the title deeds. But why should that be?
But how did we get here in the first place? How is it that 1% of the population own 50% of the land in England, and that we only have a right to roam in 8% of it, rather than the places that the majority of us live?
Well, you know, in the campaigning work that myself and others do, we often talk about enclosure and the roots of enclosure, the fact that we have 1,000 years and more, you know, been effectively losing our customary rights, and these kind of complex networks of belonging and custodianship that run deep into our kind of histories. I mean, with the Norman Conquest, you know, came massive sweeping changes to how our rights were seen on land and on water. The feudal lords that had the land, you know, divided up amongst them. I mean, the power that was then enacted in their name to disenfranchise people from the land around them, and not just physically, you know, disconnecting people from the land or uprooting them, but also do their very best to remove their rights there as well. Whether it's the, you know, right to collect firewood or the right to pannage to put pigs out. You know, these are kind of things that are seen as quirks now in places like the New Forest, in places like Dartmoor, where some of these rights still exist. But there was a time in England and Wales where those rights were widespread. This is particularly in the 1800s and 1900s that we were kind of losing these rights, but they extend way, way back beyond then. And I think the loss of our sense of community and our sense of belonging in the countryside is partly due to the focusing of power and wealth in the hands of very few people. And, you know, it's easy to dismiss that as something that happened, you know, during the Norman Conquest and, you know, the centuries that followed. But, you know, we're also seeing that today. We're seeing further enclosures happening today. We might have broadly lost our rights to commons across England, but we're increasingly losing rights of access. We're losing customary rights because of the whims of large landowners. I mean, up on Dartmoor recently, a landowner, Alexander Darwall, took the National Park to court to attempt to have the right to wild camp removed. Now, you know, he was unsuccessful after 3 years of legal challenges, but it demonstrates just, you know, how these rights, these common rights, are still under attack and are still subject to attrition. You know, the rift that has occurred between humans and the rest of nature is very largely down to the economic forces that have been at play in the countryside. You know, the role capitalism's had in shaping how we value the land, how we value labour, the structures that have been put in place to favour the privileged few, and the kind of loss of the customary rights, which were then replaced by layers of enclosure laws. And, you know, all of that, I suppose, is to say that perhaps what we had, almost by accident, which was that we were subsisting, you know, largely, you know, as community on the land, was then later replaced with something else. And today, you know, one of the great issues that we have in the countryside is that we put out of sight and out of mind the harms that we do to nature, and partly that's because in many cases we literally can't see it, we can't get to it. You know, much of the ecological destruction that has gone on and is going on in the countryside, because of limited access, people are not able to see. We don't have a sense of the baseline and the shifting baseline that's occurring ecologically. Where people feel connected and have that basis in access, people do notice the changes. They notice when the red starts don't come back. They notice when there's a lower population of a certain type of beetle, or they notice when the lichens disappear from a particular tree. That is the reality. Connection brings a sense of responsibility and a sense of stewardship. And I think that, you know, we can't ignore the fact that that would shape policy and that would shape decision-making in the countryside. You know, having said all of that, we also do need other reforms. It's no point saying that access reform is going to fix all of the woes that we have in rural areas when it comes to how we choose to use land. I mean, take Dartmoor, for example. You know, Dartmoor is no stranger to kind of the access debate with wild camping and other access issues up there. But yet, Dartmoor's main issue is that as a national park, it's in decline ecologically, and you know, we've barely got curlew clinging on up there. The peat bogs have been drained and you know, are slowly being restored, but really that needs to happen much faster. And the most of the trees have been cut down historically, and you know, Dartmoor really in a more ecologically complete state would have far more trees and would be much wetter on the higher moors, and would have a very different grazing regime with much, you know, far fewer sheep and, you know, cattle grazing in certain areas. And I think seeing those kind of changes and understanding them and you know, putting them into context, you know, is an access issue, because this is about how the public perceive landscapes which are undergoing change anyway, and how, you know, what our vision really is for the future. So I see those combined. And it's also, you know, this is like, this is about re-democratising the countryside. This is about giving people the right to feel that we have a shared sense of stewardship, a right to have a say in how land is managed, you know, for the benefit of people and for nature. You know, I have great respect for land managers and farmers and the work that they do. But yeah, I think we need a much broader base of how we perceive democracy and decision making in the countryside. And I think that comes partly through the rights of nature movements that are big in conversation at the moment, but also it's about giving the public and the, you know, people that live nearby in community the right to have a say as well in how the land is stewarded. Recently, back in July this year, a Right to Roam campaign went down to Dorset, and we were down in Dorset on the Bridehead estate, which had been held by the same landed gentry family for seven generations, the Williams family. And the most recent owner, the most recent generation of the Williams, decided to sell off the land. Presumably, it was time to cash in. And I think literally sold off the family silver at auction out on the front lawn. And, you know, this is a massive estate, thousands of acres between Dorchester and Bridport. And, you know, at the heart of this estate is a village of, I think, 36 houses, I think six tenant farms, and a large area of amenity grounds that had been for the last 60 years open to the public to enjoy. Now, you know, the Williams had this sort of benevolent view of both access and also, you know, seemingly how they treated their tenants. But at the point of sale, when they sold to, who I can only assume were the highest bidder, a corporation called Bellport bought the estate and overnight closed the amenity grounds for access, so the people in the village could no longer go in to see the lake and sit by the lake and enjoy the stream. And then rumours started to spread of evictions in the village, and as Bellport presumably began to look at their newly found assets. Now, you know, these were just rumours, but overnight people's sense of security in that village had changed, shaped by a new landlord. And I think, you know, we often forget that in rural areas these are the same issues that come from the same root, the same system, which is that we have developed a way of seeing land and property as a resource to have profit extracted from it. I mean, why else would you own an estate in the countryside under that logic? You would purchase it presumably to turn a profit. But for some reason we've sort of grown up, I think most of us have grown up with this belief that, oh, the old aristocracy and the old gentry, you know, they've got our you know, best wishes at heart, and they've you know, they're really, you know, they're good old, you know, slightly eccentric, you know, friendly old folk. You know, sometimes that might be true, but we're seeing an increasing corporatisation of the countryside, an increasing view to turn a profit, and actions which are targeted at extracting value from land and from people.
We've heard a lot about the impacts of land access on communities in the countryside, but what about those of us, like me, now living in the UK cities? How is the unequal distribution of land felt and experienced in urban areas, and what impact does this have?
Well, in urban areas, I mean, I suppose, you know, on paper you could say, well, people are far more likely to live within, you know, 15 minutes or whatever statistic you want to pick out of a hat
to a green space, or, you know, even access to rivers. But what does that mean really for people, and how do people understand that access, and is it the same to be able to go and walk in a kind of manicured park where all of the large trees are fenced off from us to be able to touch them? And, you know, having said that, you know, looking at London and you know, many other towns and cities where, you know, a lot of those green spaces are, you know, historical commons, they are, you know, often old hunting forests. Hyde Park and St James's are, you know, they were the preserve of the crown, and, you know, which in turn was land that was taken originally from the people. And so there's this kind of radical history which sits within the green spaces, you know, many of the green spaces within our towns and cities, which have been the sites of often quite literal battles over people's customary rights to common, to customary rights to access. And then, you know, it's later on in the 1800s that, you know, urban planners and people like William Pitt, you know, talking about the lungs of the city, and, you know, the fact that these green spaces are really, really important for people's health and well-being. And the landed, forward-thinking elite of the time, you know, who started to have a kind of a socialist awakening in terms of how people kind of should be able to, could be able to access these spaces that were previously gated. I think was, you know, a part of the kind of revolution, the open spaces revolution, that we you know, ended up with things like the establishment of the National Trust and the Open Spaces Society, who are fighting for access today. So, you know, those places in cities are really important parts of the history of the open access movement. I think, though, that there is a kind of qualitative consideration to take into account when it comes to, you know, what is a park? What does it mean to people? What is the countryside? You know, why is it that we sort of venerate the Hyde Park, for example, but then when you get to the edge of London, you can't step out into the Greenbelt because it's suddenly off limits? You know, what about the people that live out in the kind of the rural urban fringe in those kind of suburbs? And, you know, what if you don't live in a town that has good parks? Why can't we access our rivers when we get out into the countryside? But then we put promenades up against our rivers in the city. You know, there's different kind of qualitative assessments of what it means to kind of celebrate and have green spaces and blue spaces in cities as opposed to the countryside. And there are many people that obviously fall in the gaps in between, where you don't have a nearby park and you don't live near to a national park. And so, you know, you basically, like, the countryside around you might as well just be wallpaper. The issues that we have with how landlords behave and subjugate and extract rent from people, and, you know, it's up to their own internal moral code as to, you know, whether they want to behave in a good way or a bad way towards their renters. And, you know, unfortunately many people, you know, behave very badly. You know, it's brilliant, obviously there's organisations like London Renters Union and others that are kind of, you know, standing up for renters' rights, but, you know, many people are in a very precarious position precisely because of the way that we see land ownership, property ownership, as an asset to be exploited. But the same issues occur in the countryside. The Land Workers Alliance, you know, are constantly fighting for better working conditions for people who rent land in the countryside, to give access to land, people that literally want to grow the food that we eat. You know, it's a shocking state of affairs that people who are skilled and knowledgeable about how to work in the countryside and to grow food and to, you know, rear animals are having to fight against this really, you know, the system which gives rise to a precarious livelihood.
So on a national level, what have the government done about unequal land access? Well, the Labour Party had pledged to introduce a right to roam in England and Wales similar to that in Scotland. However, like many other manifesto promises, it was dropped. I spoke to Lewis about why, what the Labour government has done since, and how you can get involved.
Last year's election, they promised to bring in a right to roam, which later got quietly shelved, and we're told in no small part because of lobbying by the National Farmers Union, the NFU. So, you know, they rolled over on that. But still, you know, this is the government that brought in the National Parks Act, the kind of pre-war national work on National Parks Act, which was later brought in to give people rights of access to those places. They were the same government that brought in the Countryside and Rights of Way Act in the year 2000, which gave us access to 8% of England. It's not too wishful thinking to think that the government, a Labour government in 2025, should bring in a more equal access to the countryside, foundational rights of responsible access. You know, we're not asking for a huge amount. We're asking essentially for a government to finish business that it began decades ago. Now, Labour's current commitments to access has been watered down to just 9 new river walks for the whole of England. We still don't know the details on that. At the time of we're recording this, we're still waiting to hear where they might be, but presumably one in each region of England. 9 new river walks. Yeah, that is a tiny, tiny fraction of rivers in England. This is like an absurdly small amount compared to the places where people live. You know, presumably most people won't live near one of these rivers. You know, we don't really know what this is going to look like yet, but it will make very little difference for the vast majority of people. The Right to Roam campaign, you know, we've responded obviously kind of welcoming something on access, but pointing out that this is minuscule compared to what's needed. As we do as a campaign, we use trespass as a way of illuminating the issues. And our amazing local groups have been busy through November and into December trespassing, doing 9 river trespasses in response to the government's pledge of 9 new river walks, and asking the question, why not my river? Because most people will have that very valid question to ask, which is that if you give access to one river, then why not the neighbouring river? Why not the river in the next catchment? You know, why should some people benefit when the vast majority of people miss out, when there is a very obvious solution waiting, which is to give people a foundational right of responsible access, which would give everybody the ability to go down and sit with their nearby river, swim in their nearby river, because we currently don't have legal right to do that, paddle on their river, just connect with it, be with it. That's what we're asking for. So we've been campaigning for 5 years now on land access, on rights of access to land and water. We've had loads of successes in that time. We've shone a spotlight on enclosures and losses of access, both large and small. Probably the biggest moment that we've had in recent years that we can claim as a success is that we campaigned against Alexander Darwall's challenge to wild camping rights on Dartmoor. We're winning the arguments, I think, and we're pushing the debate forward politically and socially. There's a head of steam now behind this campaign. People are passionate about it. We've got really, really active local groups. We've got a lot of MPs, politicians that are on side and want to see greater rights of access to the countryside. They want to see something much more ambitious from this government. And so the campaign's going from strength to strength. There's loads of ways to get involved. And you can join one of our local groups. We've got local groups across the country now. You can find out where your nearest local group is on our website. Or if you're feeling up for it, get in touch and see about setting up a local group, because we're always having people get in touch and we can sometimes link people up. When the government finally get their act together to consult on access, which they will at some point, then we'll be calling on all of our supporters to put into that consultation and to demand robust and much greater rights of access to the countryside.
If you want to learn more, search for the Right to Roam campaign's latest film, Our Land, which is out now. Next week, I'll be speaking with Maimuna Arafin, an artist, community organiser, writer and founder of Fungi Futures. Thank you for listening. Beneath the City of Soil was created and produced by me, Robin Moffat, with the support of Transmission Roundhouse.